I'm Sarah Gonzalez in with Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. President Trump has failed to dismantle the Affordable Care Act for now, but today he has set his sights on another piece of President Obama's legacy to pick apart, the Clean Power Plan. The CPP, as it's known, created a roadmap for closing down hundreds of heavily polluting coal power plants. It stops new plants from opening and replaces them with wind and solar farms. Trump's latest executive order would decimate the Clean Power Plan and scale back other environmental regulations, including the ones aimed at reducing vehicle emissions. At a rally in Kentucky last week, the president promised his actions would bring back coal mining jobs.
As we speak, we are preparing new executive actions to save our coal industry and to save our wonderful coal miners from continuing to be put out of work. The miners are coming back.
Many economists are skeptical that rolling back these rules would actually restore coal jobs. The demand for coal has been shrinking for years. In just a minute, we'll hear from an economist who agrees that the Clean Power Plan is bad for business. But if environmentalists take the Trump administration to court, it could be years before the actions take effect. Coral Davenport is an energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Hi, Coral. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Sarah. It's great to be with you.
In terms of what this could mean, what rolling back this regulation could mean, in 2015, almost every country signed a climate pact. Almost every country agreed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is the Paris Agreement. Now, the White House has not explicitly said that it will pull out of the Paris Agreement, but Coral, you write that undoing Obama's Clean Power Plan would make it virtually impossible for the United States to meet the goal that it pledged to the world in an international agreement. So what are the consequences of this?
So under the 2015 Paris Agreement, the United States, the largest economy in the world, largest historic greenhouse polluter, put forth a pledge that the U.S. would cut its emissions about 26% from 2005 levels by 2025. In order to meet that commitment, the U.S. would both have to fully implement the Clean Power Plan and additional new regulations on top of that. If you take away the Clean Power Plan, it pretty much means there's no way the U.S. will be able to meet its commitment. And it also sends a signal to the rest of the world that it's not interested in trying.
And we know that Trump and his administration have called climate change policies some names. When could changes take effect, though, Coral? There is an issue of legal challenges.
What we'll see today is an executive order. But as one legal expert told me, the order itself has about the legal impact of a tweet. He will be telling his Environmental Protection Agency administrator, you go start doing this. That's a lot easier said than done. Those regulations were put forth under an existing law, under a very rigorous regulatory process mandated by statute. This whole process could easily take up to 2 years, maybe even more. And there's certainly no question that it will be met every step along the way with resistance and also with lawsuits. And at the end of the day, the expectation is probably this will end up before the Supreme Court, before we really know what's going to happen.
Other environmental regulations are on the line here, too. How much of Obama's legacy are we looking at?
So the Clean Power Plan really is the heart of President Obama's climate legacy. But he also put forth a sort of a suite of smaller executive orders, memorandums. And so it will be a lot easier for President Trump to quickly sweep those away. Last year, President Obama announced a temporary ban on new coal leasing on federal lands. That was one of those executive orders that presidents do with a stroke of a pen. It will be undone. Another thing, this is sort of a wonky and obscure thing, but it has a lot of impact. President Obama's economists essentially created a price for the cost of carbon pollution. Each ton of carbon pollution, they assign a cost of $36 per ton. That number equates to the amount of damage to the economy done by each ton of carbon pollution. So you multiply that by, you know, hundreds or millions of tons of carbon pollution annually, and that comes out to an annual price tag for the economic damage done by the impacts of climate change, by rising sea levels, increased flooding, increased drought. And that was very important because when the Obama administration put forth its climate regulations, they acknowledged that they would have an economic cost, that they would hurt the coal industry. But they were able to kind of pair that, do a cost-benefit analysis and say, but it will prevent sort of this level of economic damage. It's expected that the Trump administration is going to basically try to revise, review, and probably eliminate the social cost of carbon. Once they wipe it from the books, they can create new regulations that are much, much weaker and do a cost-benefit analysis that does not take into account the economic impact of climate change, sort of takes away the rationale for stringent, ambitious regulations and creates an economic rationale for extremely weak and industry-friendly regulations, which is what we would expect to see emerging at some point once the Obama rules are rolled back.
Coral Davenport is an energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Coral, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
While environmentalists and people who worry about climate change may be dreading the repeal of the Clean Power Plan, which you just heard about, many in the energy business are celebrating. Critics of the CPP believe that the plan would have increased energy costs and hit low-income people with higher costs. The CPP regulations have also been blamed for shutting down older coal-fired power plants and for halting construction of new ones, putting more pressure on jobs in that sector. Does repeal of the Clean Power Plan mean a 21st century renaissance for the coal industry? Wayne Weingarten is senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute. He studied the potential economic impact of the CPP, and he joins me now to explain why its repeal might be good for the average American. Wayne Weingarten, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've said that the CPP could and would mean higher costs for people on limited incomes. What have you found?
We found that right now, energy costs are a much larger burden for lower income people, and that makes sense, right? They have a smaller budget, and energy costs are pretty much a fixed cost. So they're more burdensome on lower income individuals. And when you increase those costs, and the CPP would have significantly increased energy costs, you're going to have a much larger impact, not only on lower income families and lower income households, but you're also going to have a regional impact. So the Southeast and the Midwest were going to be hurt significantly more than, let's say, the West Coast would have been.
And what have you found about the actual impact? Take a family making $50,000 in Canton, Ohio, if you like.
If you're talking about an average family and $50,000, you're talking about an average family. Right now, they have about 2.7% of their income is devoted towards energy costs. And if you would have had the CPP, you're talking about another 0.5% of their income that would have been forced into expenditures on energy. And obviously, when you look at the stagnating income that we've had, and that's really been the bottom 50, bottom 60% of households, haven't seen their incomes grow since 2000 once you adjust for inflation. You put these regulations on top of that, and you're really putting a lot of families in a very large financial bind.
So, Wayne, it's all understandable. This was the same argument that was made against cap and trade when Democrats tried to pass that through Congress in the mid-2000s. There are, of course, ways around this. Congress decided that health insurance could also be a burden on families, the cost of premiums, so they subsidized it. Why not do that here?
We have to remember, when you subsidize, subsidies don't come from heaven. They're not something that's magically created. When a government offers a subsidy, it takes money from one place and gives it to someplace else. That transfer on net has no economic or positive economic impact. What you are doing are creating a lot of distortions, creating a lot of inefficiencies, and that overall is going to reduce our economic growth. And part of the solution to a lot of these issues, whether it's health insurance, whether it's energy costs, is reinvigorating the economy, reinvigorating growth, so we can get back up to the average 3% growth that we've seen since the end of World War II.
But I wonder if your studies into the costs on individual families also include the economic price of carbon and the price of the impact of climate change.
There are investments we can be making currently that would impact that. Why we're not building more nuclear plants, which is a very clean, sustainable energy source, that is a great solution that we should be investigating more. What we want to do is empower people and empower entrepreneurs in innovation. That doesn't come from Washington, D.C. That comes from the thousands, the millions of people and the innovators. Bureaucracies don't innovate. People do. So part of what, when we're talking about the cost of climate change and how do we address that, we want to have a lot of experiments going on. We want to empower the economy and empower people to come up with these solutions, not direct them from Washington, D.C.
Wayne Weingarten is Senior Fellow at the Pacific Research Institute. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.